Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 13th. The first order of business is approval of the minutes for March 6th. Representative Moran moves approval of the minutes for March 6th. Is there any corrections, changes, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have four items on our agenda for today. Three bills. The first thing we're going to start off with is a nonpartisan review by nonpartisan research on the Workforce Development Fund that is under the purview of our committee. We'll start off with Mr. Zempel, who will cover the expenditures, revenues, a little bit more of the technical aspects of it. And members, I still believe you should have the summary spreadsheet from the end of last session that contains more of the aggregate numbers on that side. So, Mr. Zempel, if you could proceed with your presentation, and as always, introduce yourself for the tape. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Zempel, nonpartisan fiscal analysis department. Today I'll be going through the Workforce Development Fund. This fund was created in the laws of 1990 as a dedicated fund for the dislocated worker program managed by the Job Skills Partnership Board. The partnership board gets funding from the Workforce Development Fund, as well as manages the federal dislocated worker program. The resources into the fund, into the Workforce Development Fund, come from a 0.1% special assessment on all taxable wages, which follows the same guidelines, rules as the unemployment insurance program. And Minnesota statute defines taxable wages as 60% of the average Minnesota wage for that year and caps it. So that means the employer only pays this special assessment on that calculated number, which for 2018 is $32,000. In fiscal year 17, the board collected $56.8 million through the special assessment, which was a 7.5% increase over 2016. And as you know, the legislature, so not only are these funds available for the dislocated worker program, the legislature also directly appropriates funds or programs from this fund. For fiscal year 18, the legislature appropriated $37.7 million, and for fiscal year 19, $36.4 million. You can actually find this in the second graph that I've provided, and you can see a short history of legislative appropriations compared with dislocated worker program spending. Now, there is something to caution you about here, is that in the actual years, fiscal 14 through fiscal 17, versus the November forecast years, fiscal 18 through 21, the dislocated worker spending changes. So the program always anticipates in the out years that they spend every dollar down to $1 million at the bottom of the fund. However, when we come to fiscal year-end close, they always go back and readjust the fund with what they actually spent. And since 2014, the average of the prior year adjustments have been just shy of $26 million a year. If you look at the third chart, you will notice it's a comparison of revenue versus legislative appropriations, and revenue over time, as you expect, as salaries go up and labor force participation increases, the revenue also tracks upward, and you'll notice that legislative appropriations we're tracking upward through about fiscal 19, but in the tails, due to the work last session, have come down to the numbers, or about the percentage that the legislature spent out of there in fiscal year 14 and 15. And, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Zempel. And, Mr. Zempel, just a quick question. So, again, can you explain once again the interaction with the dislocated worker program? I know that there are non-workforce development fee revenues that fund that. But can you just explain how that interaction works at the end of each fiscal year?
Mr. Chair, all resources in the Workforce Development Fund not appropriated by the legislature are available to the Job Skills Partnership Board for the Dislocated Worker Program. The board always anticipates spending every dollar available to it, and that's what they forecast every year into the future. Once we go through actuals and we close the fiscal year, they then report what they actually spent, and on average, since fiscal 14, there's $25 million on the bottom line each year. In fiscal 17, there was $22 million on the bottom line.
And does the Job Skills Partnership Board, does that fund have carryover authority, or does it cancel back to the general fund?
Any funds not spent in the Workforce Development Fund are canceled to the Workforce Development Fund, not to the general fund.
Thank you. Questions for members of the committee? An exceptionally thorough presentation, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So years ago when this fund was first established, one of the things we looked at was providing opportunity for training for folks that included things like community college and some other opportunities beyond just the specific professional development that they needed in a particular job. And I'm just wondering, I don't remember when that went away exactly. I don't, did you run across that when you were looking here at, about, you know, the ability of people to be able to have their educational opportunities for job training, have a little more, a little broader focus? I'm just wondering if you ran across that or not. It was in the early years when we first established it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I am not certain of the portion of this program that you refer to, but I can look into that and get back to you.
That would be good.
Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Thank you, Mr. Zempel. Appreciate the overview of the Workforce Development Fund for the committee. Members, next is we're going to take up a bill that we actually heard last week. Representative Fabian had House File 1535. Representative Fabian moves House File 1535 be recommended to pass and refer to the Tax Committee. And then Representative Fabian, looks like the DE1 amendment is the one that made the changes that prevented us from taking action on it last week.
Yep.
So Representative Fabian moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill to the floor and the author would like. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The bill is adopted. And Representative Fabian, we did hear your bill last week, so I'm not really sure if we need an overview of it once again. We can point out to members that there is a, as of March 6th, I think this is an updated fiscal note in there that would
not
an updated fiscal note. Okay, so this is the old one. So it's still coming. The bill now as amended is still coming from revenue, right? Mr. Zempel, let's be clear.
Yep. Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. So, again, members, this is not for the view before us now is as a policy matter. The financing for this bill would be a reduction in revenue from the Tax Committee, which is, I believe, how we had presented it to the committee. So. Representative Fabian, do you wish to add anything at all?
No, I want to thank Anna and Mr. Zempel and Charlene for working on this stuff. I know it's kind of a technical adjustment. We're not changing any of the substance of the bill. What we're trying to do to provide more workforce housing, and if Ms. Charlene wants to go through some of the technicalities of that, I'd appreciate it. I will say that one thing on the second page, line 2.16 and 2.17, what we're doing there is is we're establishing workforce and affordable home ownership development account within the housing development fund. But I'm sure that House staff can explain it probably more thoroughly than I can.
If they want to, but I think we understand the gist of the bill. Unless you guys really want to or not.
It's up to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, it's up to them, and they just gave me the, they shook me off as the, what's that, Mr.? Yeah, there is an updated summary for members available.
Yep.
So, any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Again, this is something that from a policy sense we've covered, but the spending for this, if were to become law, would come out of the tax committee as a revenue reduction. All right, Representative Fabian, any closing comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Fabian renews his motion to have House File 1535 as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Tax Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. You're on your way to taxes. Thank you, Representative Fabian. Representative Moran. Representative Moran moves that House File 1591 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Moran, do you have any amendments to your bill?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran, to your bill. Now, you've presented a bill to the committee before, correct?
I did, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Okay, so there's the reason that there's no treats is because you've presented it. So that's...
Well,
first time you present to this committee, you bring treats. Oh, I don't care how long you've been here. So that's... But... Just, And if it wasn't the rule before, it is now. So, but just, we want to make sure, I know committee members take careful notes of these matters. We want to make sure that you're getting due credit for your work. So,
all right.
Representative Moran, to House File 1591.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to bring House File 1591 before this committee again. And I will share a little bit about the initiative, and then I have a testifier here. And I have a few testifiers. So the Community Ambassador Initiative was developed in 2013 in cooperation with the St. Paul Police Department. Community ambassadors consist of culturally relevant outreach professionals that are frequently well known to the youth that they serve. For the purpose of this committee, the Community Ambassador Initiative provide employment service and work readiness training for 120 high-risk youth to transition into regular jobs. So I'm going to end there. I have some testifiers who are more versed on the initiative who will share their knowledge.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joel Franklin. I'm the director of the Community Ambassadors Initiative. Thank you for having me today. Just to give you a little background on community ambassadors, we started about 5 years ago in response to a large complaints from the business community and residents downtown St. Paul. Actually, they called a meeting with former Mayor Coleman, really looking for more police presence downtown. At the time, Police Chief Tom Smith was the chief, and he felt that you can't arrest your way out of this problem. So he brought in an expert in community outreach work, Billy Collins, who was the director of the YWCA at the time, and they decided to hire community outreach workers to try to deal with the problem downtown. So they did a summer pilot where they hired about 12 outreach workers. These were individuals from the community that worked in the rec centers, in the schools, and the nonprofits. They knew the kids. The first summer, they were able to reduce juvenile crime downtown by 40%, and it was a 40% reduction in juvenile arrests. Due to the success of the initiative for that summer, the initiative branched out throughout the city. So they're in all districts of the police districts, the Eastern District, the Central District, and the Western District. The first year, we were able to reduce juvenile arrests by 63%. The expertise of the individuals were, these are community outreach workers that have a relationship with the young people. They were able to reduce juvenile crime and juvenile arrests by engaging with the young people, building relationship, and then referring them to services to help them. And we all know the best way in order to keep young people out of the criminal justice system is to provide a job for them. So what we're asking for funding now is to expand our job program. We already have a certain number of slots, subsidized employment that we work with the youth to provide employment experience for them. you know, we work with the high-risk young people. These are survival-based youth at that intersection of race and poverty with a lot of trauma at home. So they take a lot of intensive support in order to be successful. And our ultimate goal is for them to be successful in life. If these young people end up in the criminal justice system and have a felony or a criminal record, then it's going to be that much difficult for them to get a job in the future. So what we're asking for is funding to, as Representative Moran stated, to create 60 subsidized employment slots where we will run 120 high-risk young people through those slots. Our goal would be to transition those 60 young people into permanent jobs, which is the ultimate goal, and then bring in another 60 through those slots. I think I'm going to stop there. I do have, we have with us Deputy Commander of the St. Paul Police, Matt Topol. I'm sorry, I forgot about the demotion. Deputy Chief of Police Matt Topol, who works closely with the Community Ambassador Initiative, and he was going to give some information about the importance of the initiative to the police department. And then we also struck a strong relationship with BOMA, the Building Owners and Management Association, who've been a great support in helping the initiative be successful and raise money. So we had Julie Bach as a representative from there to give some testimony.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Matt Topol. I'm the Deputy Chief of Operations for the St. Paul Police Department, and I've had a relationship with the ambassadors for about 4 years now. For me, in a police perspective, what the ambassadors has meant is they have been the buffer between at-risk youth and the police. This administration, meaning the police department under Chief Axtell, we're about building relationships and trying to mitigate some of these long-term issues that we've had. And the goal is to try to have as many positive contacts as we possibly can with the ambassadors working as a buffer. It has impacted the relationships that we have with youth and at-risk youth in some of our challenging neighborhoods. I've seen it firsthand. I can give you several different examples of where I've seen the impact of large events that we have in the city. For example, Rondo, Senko, Wiper Avenue Parade, Rice Street Parade. We work with the ambassadors. We actually have the ambassadors in a pre-brief or a roll call before the event starts so we can introduce the ambassadors. Countless times the ambassadors have mitigated fights, issues before they begin, and we don't even have to get involved. We work with the ambassadors almost on a daily basis, but they're out there weekly in some of our neighborhoods, challenging neighborhoods throughout the city. And again, we provide them with information. We're experiencing some difficulties with at-risk youth or with youth in particular. And because of their expertise, the ambassadors, they go in there and they mitigate a lot of the issues that we have, which from an administrative standpoint, not only does it allow us to have the opportunity to build positive relationships with the youth, but also reallocate resources, maybe other priorities. The word ambassador, or the definition of ambassador, is to be a diplomat or liaison representing a specific group or entity. This is exactly what they have done for our city and for our police department. The ambassadors have been a liaison for the community to voice their concerns and needs to the police, and likewise have been liaison for the police to voice our concerns and needs to the community. I can go on, and I'll be honest with you, this ambassador program has worked for us. Anything that we can do, especially with youth, at-risk youth, to turn them in a direction where they can be productive in our society, and where they can build those relationships with the police. There are some people that struggle with the police nationally. If you watch the news on a regular basis, you're going to see that there's been some struggles. We're taking steps to make our communities better and safer, and this ambassador program is definitely one of those programs that we feel has been successful, and I absolutely love the work that they do and the relationships that not, they have not only built with us, but with the youth in our community.
Thank you, Deputy Chief. Any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Representative Moran, do you have an additional testifier?
Yes, I have one other testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Julie Bach. I am board chair of downtown St. Paul BOMA. I say downtown because that's predominantly where I am familiar with the youth issues that we've had in St. Paul. I'm also I manage one of the largest buildings in downtown Lower St. Paul. And I can tell you that originally I became familiar with the ambassador program approximately 3 years ago. Originally, BOMA was a little bit reticent to engage in a program that they weren't familiar with, and it has been such a success, and we have personally seen that level of success in St. Paul to the point where we, for the last 2 years, have sponsored a gala, a fundraising gala specifically for the ambassador initiative. I do know the ambassadors by name, by face. I see them downtown. They introduce me to youth. I now recognize many of the young people that are downtown, can call them by name. They're very respectful. It's a completely different change to have the ambassadors engaged with the youth in St. Paul. Different from the police presence, which I'm sure you can understand, you know, someone in uniform versus someone that is just in street clothes and engaged and know these youth by their name and by their family situations. So I would just... I'm here to support and strongly urge you to support the ambassador program as well.
Thank you, Ms. Bach. Representative Clark.
Thank you. Representative Moran, this sounds like an excellent program, and I'm glad to hear all the positive work that's going on. I'm just wondering, maybe from the witness or maybe it would be from the officer before, have you been dealing with the issue of juvenile prostitution or some of those issues as well, or is it, I'm just wondering, it seems like it would be such a great outreach to some of those folks.
Definitely not my, okay. My all right. Expertise.
All right.
Deputy Chief.
Thank you. To answer your question, juvenile prostitution, I do know a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you it's an environment where... You have to know what you're looking for, because a lot of time these at-risk youth, they don't want to be found out. Mm-hmm. This is actually, we're just talking about having additional training to include the ambassadors to be able to spot exactly what you're talking about. It's kind of funny you're bringing it up, but absolutely. We have talked about and included them in some of our trainings, as well as the fire department. But this is exactly that avenue that we're in and we're headed down.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
It's so good to hear that, because and it sounds like you have some expertise, and I would be interested in just following up maybe with you afterwards about how we might employ this in some other communities too. It's such a need, and it sounds like you've already started to address it, so thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. This is a public testimony. Are there any members of the public that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Any other member questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moran, thank you for bringing this bill forward. We had a nice conversation in the hallway last week or the week before. I've lost track of the time here, but I have done a little bit of research on the Haida Q. Brown Community Center, and when I take, could I get Mr. Franklin to come back, maybe? I'm very interested in, and I want you to explain to the committee and the people who are here, the people that make up the board of directors and of the Haida Q. Brown Community Center there. It's an interesting bunch to me. Maybe there's somebody else that needs to answer, because I know you're with the with the ambassadors,
right.
But it's through the community center. And I'm very impressed with the people who are board of directors, members of the Brown Center. And I think it's important for members to hear who's engaged in this.
Mr. Franklin.
Thank you, Chairperson and Representative Fabian. Actually, the executive director of Haida Q. Brown Community Center is sitting here, Jonathan Palmer. He'd be better to answer that question.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with answering the question. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Jonathan Palmer. I'm the executive director of Hallie Q. Brown Community Center. We are an 89-year-old organization that comes out of the Settlement House movement, an African-American social service agency open to everyone. So we have been the historic gathering place of the African-American community in St. Paul. To speak to our board of directors, we have a very diverse board of directors that covers industry, that covers nonprofit community, and covers people from the neighborhoods as well. Our board chair is with 3M. Our vice chair is with the Minnesota and St. Paul Foundations. We have board members from Briggs & Morgan. We have retired Ramsey County district judge. We have a wide cross-section of people who are actively engaged within the center and actively engaged within the community. I can talk more about our organization, but the Ambassadors is a program that has been integral. We have a lot of social services there. They are able to reach out to people on the streets and help them connect into our food shelf, our clothing closets, our early learning center. A lot of the services that they need are right there on site. So the Ambassadors being located there helps them to connect into people's needs and also helps us to do outreach within the community.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Or, excuse me, Representative Fabian.
That's okay. Just actually, we refer to each other as brother and sister. So.
Oh, that's so nice.
We have so much in common.
We do.
I'm also, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm also curious about your funding and your benefactors. Again, that's something that I found to be fairly inspirational. Help me out.
Mr. Palmer.
Madam Chair and Representative Fabian, we are kind of unique in that we're about 50% self-funded. So our organization is a nonprofit organization, but we have programs that do fee-for-service, such as the Early Learning Center, Youth Enrichment. We also have room rentals, and we have organizations who are actually permanently located there that pay rent to us. So we generate about 50% of our funds by ourselves just from income streams. We are a United Way agency. United Way was actually our first funder back in 1929 with $1,000, back when it was called the Community Chest, and they have been a consistent funder since that time. The other 25% is made up of individual donations, contributions that come from individuals, foundation grants, and things along our fundraisers and stuff.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the other thing, Representative Moran, that you and I talked about is young boys, men, young men in the community and so forth. One of the things that I was impressed about with the Ambassadors program is there seems to be a lot of one-on-one interaction with young boys, who young men who in some cases don't get that mentorship, they don't get that father figure, and this program provides that to them to a certain degree. Can somebody talk a little bit more about that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Fabian. I mean, that is one of the highlights of the Community Ambassador Program. When you're dealing with young people who are at high risk, meaning they may be homeless, they may be, there are other issues that's going on within the home, you have a group of people who know them by name, who's able to walk them through some of that disconnection that will otherwise be in the household for these young people. That is critical and unique to an urban core where there's a lot that's going on in a community. One of the things that really helped me to see the value in the Community Ambassador Initiative is that when I heard about the young people who was hanging out in downtown St. Paul, just hanging out because they didn't have anything else to do, right? And the businesses in St. Paul were really, they was a little bit unpleased about them hanging out and thought, we just need a bigger presence of police and get them out the way. And through the Community Ambassador commitment and the relationship that they had with the young people, but also was in conversation with the small business, the businesses in downtown St. Paul, and we know that when we create an opportunity for young people to be busy doing something constructive, it's a win-win. And what they was able to do through the summer jobs were get them jobs, the ability to connect with some of those soft skills and to value hard work. And through that, it was those small business owners, those business owners in downtown St. Paul who became a champion of this initiative. And so it became a win-win, you know, because sometimes you just need that father or mother figure, someone who can walk you through life, who can give you the support that you otherwise don't see within your own self. And this is a part of what the community ambassador personally do. But it also is really a focus and a target on employment, which our young people need.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How do you use one-time money?
Representative Moran. Mr. Franklin.
Thank you, Chairperson and Representative. Representative Fabian had asked a couple of questions prior to this hearing, and we submitted an email to you with the answers to the questions. So I can submit that to everyone as well. But what we plan on using with the one-time money, I mean, since the initiative has been implemented, we have received most of our funding from local and corporate foundations. So we, after a year or so of having success, we were able to get funding from the City of St. Paul, and then we also picked up a contract from the MTC Police, Metro Transit Police Chief John Harrington was very impressed with the work we were doing, and St. Paul Public Schools went to school bus passes, and they needed help with the increased population downtown taking the bus. So they contracted with us to have ambassadors at Johnson High School in downtown. So we've been seeking funding from local corporate funds. We also are looking for state and federal funds. We did receive a competitive grant from DEED last year, and then we got another one this year. So we are looking for additional funding sources. So if this is only one-time funding, we will continue to look for other funding sources to keep it going.
Representative Thiessen?
Okay, thank you. So you're going to expand the program with the money and then hope to find money to sustain that in the future.
Mr. Franklin.
Yeah, thank you. So the goal is with the additional funding is to provide more employment opportunities for young people. We already have some employment opportunities for young people. With the additional money, we'll be able to employ more individuals and help them to get permanent employment like we were stating before. So that's the game plan. And then the game plan would also to continue to look for other sources. We haven't really tapped federal money. This has been a very good initiative to address youth crime and youth violence. And there's a lot of money out there on the federal side that we haven't really tapped. So we are going to be looking for additional sources to keep it going. But at this point, I mean, like I said, we have survival-based youth, and we are providing one-on-one support with these individuals, and a lot of these individuals will end up in the criminal justice system or dead if we don't work with them. So in order to, you know, provide 120 individuals with work readiness training, job experience, and then place them in permanent jobs, even for the year, I mean, we think it'd be highly valuable.
Representative Thiessen? Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a number of questions. I don't know who cares to answer them, but I'll direct them to the author of the bill. What age of the youth, what's the age range that you speak to or this program works for? And is there a majority age of, you know, like 18 to 24 or 14 to 18? Majority of youth that you're dealing with here?
Representative Moran.
I'm going to pass it over to Joel Franklin.
Mr. Franklin.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
I'm going to pass that over to Joel Franklin to respond.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative, the age group that we work with is 15 to 24. Based on our data, most of the young people are falling between the 15 to 18 range that we work with. We do work with older youth, and we also work with younger youth because a lot of times now we have younger youth hanging out with the older youth. So, but the main range that we specialize is 15 to 24.
Thank you, Madam Chair, if I may. Are most of these employment opportunities that you're finding, are these long-term and or are they full-time or part-time?
Mr. Franklin.
The goal would be to look for permanent employment. We've had Over the years, we've been able to place young people in jobs in the city, Parks and Rec. We've been able to put young people in nonprofit jobs. We also have been able to put young people into employment at corporate or regular business jobs, coffee shops, restaurants, so on. We're excited about our relationship with BOMA. BOMA had offered to reach out to their membership to offer employment opportunities for our young people. But with the young people that we're working with, we definitely need those young people to go through the work readiness training and have that support in order for them to be successful. So we're looking for permanent jobs. That's the goal. The city's been really supportive of us. So we also have conversations with Public Works as well as Parks and Rec.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then how many ambassadors do you have, and who are these? Are these full-time people who work as ambassadors, or are they volunteers, or what?
Mr. Franklin.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, so we have about 30 ambassadors at this time. All of the ambassadors are independent contractors. They are part-time. They all have full-time, most of them have full-time jobs, I should say. Some are retired, and this is all the work they're doing at this point. But they all work in the schools. They work in the rec centers. They work in nonprofits with youth. They work in juvenile corrections. So all the ambassadors that we have extensive youth experience, and they work with youth on their day job. But the ambassadors initiative itself, like I said, they're independent contractors.
Representative Mahoney.
One more question. Do you, if you have a youth come through, and I think you, someone has mentioned anywhere from 6 to 4 years that this program has been in existence, do you have any history, or do you keep track of the youth that come through the program so that a year or two later you know if they're still at a permanently employed or full-time employed or stayed out of, lack of a better word to call it, stayed out of trouble? Do you have data on that, that at some point you could show that you're having a 90% effect on these 120 young people that you bring through every year, or a 50%?
Mr. Franklin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. That would be one thing that we're lacking. We've been in existence, it'll be 5 years this year. We've done a good job attracting the young people, the demographics of the young people that we have. We are doing a decent job of showing the reduction in juvenile arrest. We're having less of a success in tracking the success afterwards, mainly due to limited funds that we have. Most of the funds we have at this point goes to the ambassadors to have them on the street engaging the young people. So collecting the data to do the follow-up to see after we engage with them how successful they are with the initiatives or the programs that we refer them to or the jobs, we just don't really have the resources at this time to do that.
And then just, thank you, Madam Chair, and I will be brief. We try to do government on data-based proof, and it would behoove you when you come to the committee to be able to say what your success rate is 2 years, 4 years, 5 years out. Try and find the funds somewhere out of that, do one less young person, whatever it is that you have to do, so that it's simpler when you come and tell us that you're having a 90% success rate on 120 kids. That's impressive. But if you come and tell us you're having a 10% success rate, or we just have to guess, it gets harder and harder for us to kind of make a data-based decision on what's working, what's not working.
Representative Moran, did you have a comment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think that's always the challenge with a small organization with a budget of $723,000 to do that research part. And I think that absolutely that part is really important to be able to show your outcome, your impact that you're having. And I think with additional dollars that may create an opportunity for them to use some of those dollars to be able to collect some data to show some outcomes, like further on. I mean, we don't expect the great outcomes in a year, but hopefully within 2 or 3 years that they can show some type of impact And I think that's a fair request and a fair ask of the Community Ambassador Initiative.
Thank you. Representative Munson.
Hi, thank you. Madam Chairwoman, and question on the program, and unfortunately I have to ask questions over my shoulder here. I was looking at the number of hours that you'll be providing for additional community ambassadors. That $175,000, is that just for the wages of the community ambassadors?
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, correct. That would just be to pay for the ambassadors to be on the streets.
Okay, so that works out. Thank you. It works out to be $35 an hour that for the community ambassadors on the street?
Mr. Franklin.
Yes, Representative. That would cover their fee as well as administrative costs to process their payroll.
Okay.
Representative Munson.
Thank you. And then is this program similar to the Minneapolis? I noticed the Minneapolis has the community ambassadors, or they have the coats walking around downtown with the fluorescent coats. It's the ambassador. Is that a similar program?
Mr. Franklin.
I'm familiar with that initiative. I wouldn't say it is similar. I mean, I think they engage differently than us. We engage with young people on the streets. I think they do things differently. I think they were more directing individuals and answering questions. So it's not exactly the same. The purpose of our initiative was to reduce juvenile crime and violence, and we're engaging young people and trying to provide the one-on-one support. So my understanding of the Minneapolis initiative, that's not what they do.
Representative Munson.
All right, thank you. And then are there similar programs in other towns that you've modeled yours after that do have more details and follow through and how much many more youth are placed in jobs or their success with the programs?
Mr. Franklin.
I'm not familiar with any other programs that okay. Do the follow up.
Yeah. Representative Munson.
And then for the employment service and work readiness training, do you have some more details on the types of services that you offer? Do you partner with other organizations to provide that training?
Mr. Franklin.
Yes, Representative. We have several of our ambassadors actually for their day job. They do provide that type of training. So we do have individuals that actually that's their expertise. There are also other organizations that do work readiness training that we partner with. Yes.
Representative Munson.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Representative Moran, any closing comments? I don't believe we have any other questions. So. Okay. Seeing none, Representative Moran, any closing comments?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to reiterate that the community ambassador recognized the important link between employment and pathways to success for young people. The community ambassador worked with agencies that provide employment opportunities to youth who face difficult barriers to employment. And the community ambassadors understand that in order to succeed in the workplace, these youth will need individualized job search and placement assistance and long-term follow-up services. It is a great investment to invest in youth to give them a long-term vision for what it takes to hold a job, to invest in themselves and their community and have better and brighter outcomes. And so I hope that I can get the support of this committee for the Community Ambassador Initiative. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Marin. And so House File 1591 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Thiessen. Representative Thiessen moves that House File 2913 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Law. And Representative Thiessen, you have an A1 amendment to the bill?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move that to put it in the shape that I'd like it. And just basically what the amendment does is what the bill does, it would not allow basically employers to ask about someone's current or past wages and during the hiring process. This would allow employers to ask questions or clarify that they could ask questions about measures of productivity. So if you are, for instance, a salesperson, how much revenues have you generated, how many sales, other production items, which does seem to be a very fair and reasonable thing to be asking a potential employee. So that's what the amendment would do.
Thank you. And Representative Thiessen, members, even though this is came in after the 24-hour rule, I'm going to allow it today and allow it to be put on the bill to be allow the author to have the bill in the form you would like. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative House File, Representative Thiessen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've basically described what the bill does and the rationale for the bill. We do have and continue to have today gender pay gap in the state of Minnesota. It's about 85%. Or 85 cents on the dollar for women in full kind of full-time job to full-time job comparison. That's September 2017, the most recent report from Deed on that. And one of the things that we've heard, and I do have a testifier who's going to be able to talk much more specifically about this, but that we've learned is that one of the things that perpetuates that is when employers can ask what your past or your current or your past wages were, that tends to be where those wages end up. And if we already have a built-in gap, it's going to perpetuate that gap going forward. On the flip side, it's not clear to me that if that is in fact the case, that the advantages of asking that information, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that, outweigh, you know, to the extent that there are reasons to ask that question, that they outweigh the impact it has on this wage gap. But I'd actually love to have my witness, the witness come up and testify. That's okay, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Lisa Stratton. I'm an attorney and a co-founder of a nonprofit law firm and advocacy organization called Gender Justice. We at Gender Justice are deeply engaged in work to close the wage gap in Minnesota and nationally, including serving on the steering committee of an Equal Pay Today campaign with national organizations like National Women's Law Center and other state-based organizations, all of which are working together to try to do what we can to recommend policies at the state and national levels to address the wage gap in as many ways as possible. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today about this bill because it is so urgent to close not only gender but racial wage gaps in our state. Representative Thiessen has already highlighted the problem that this bill would contribute to solving. Women in Minnesota making $83.85, something in that range of dollars made by men, but that statistical, as disturbing as it is not nearly as shocking, actually, as knowing that Native American and Black women in this state make 59.4 and 59 cents, respectively, and Latinas make only 53.3 cents to the dollar as compared to white men. So in other words, women of color in our state are earning slightly more than half what men earn on average. So why do we still have this problem? We've had an Equal Pay Act for many years at the federal and state levels. Well, women are being paid less on average than men because of outright discrimination, having been historically excluded from many occupations. And even when not outright discriminated against, which has been illegal for some time, subconscious biases and stereotypes lead employers to view women negatively in negotiations and in evaluations. It also happens because women are segregated into lower paying jobs and excluded from higher paying non-traditional jobs, which is particularly true for women of color who face not only gender but racial discrimination in our workplaces. So how is this a solution? There's no one solution to the wage gap. I testified before this committee in support of multiple bills in the Women's Economic Security Act of 2014, and all of those bills were designed to close the wage gap. But this one is particularly simple. It's one way to address a long-standing problem. When employers rely on applicants' prior salary in setting their pay, pay inequities are perpetuated throughout the employees' careers. So if any prior employer in a woman's work history paid her less than they would have paid a white man, if they steered her toward lower paying support positions within the company, even though she was qualified to do other jobs, or if she previously worked in a female-dominated profession where pay is disproportionately lower than positions that require similar skill and effort but have traditionally been held by men. Let's talk, think caretaking, traditionally work performed by women that is still undervalued in our economy. So the hiring employer asked her what was she paid in her last job in order to set the amount that they'll offer her. Mm-hmm. If it does, the prior pay discrimination will always follow her, depressing her new wages. Reliance on prior salary affects individuals who have had to reduce their hours or leave a prior job for a time to care for children, for example, or for their education, because the prior compensation isn't reflective of existing market conditions or their current qualifications. And this is not just a problem of a dying past of segregated workforces and want ads. I go back to when they were in paper and there were columns for men and columns for women. The wage gap still affects young women as soon as they enter the labor force today. 1 year after college graduation, women are paid 82% of what similarly educated and experienced male peers earn. And it expands over their lifetimes. It leaves older women with a huge gap in retirement income. On average, over the course of a 40-year career, a woman who works full-time and year-round in Minnesota on average typically loses something in the ballpark of $400,000 to the wage gap over her lifetime. So these inequities just compound and compound. It isn't just women who would be benefited by having salaries based on rational business-related criteria rather than what the last job they held paid. It hurts older individuals in an aging workforce who try to enter a lower-paying job, say, at the end of their career when they are looking to still have an income. They often get screened out from consideration because their past wages were too high to meet an expectation. And it can affect individuals, perhaps someday like yourselves, but who are looking for a job following service, public service, or service in the public sector where wages are lower. So overall, this bill would help. It's not going to solve the wage gap, but it's an important step that can be taken, and it would, more than anything, encourage employers to de-bias their hiring processes. If the applicant's prior salary can't be the major determinant for the compensation that they offer an applicant, they will find job-related and market comparisons to determine what the job function's worth to the company, not how a previous employer evaluated the applicant's value at their company. It will ensure that people are paid for their new job, not their old one. And although reliance on prior salary has been a common practice, it is rapidly becoming less so, as research confirms its depressing effect on the wages of women and people of color by perpetuating discrimination. It's not a necessary business practice. To determine an applicant's value, employers can look to experience, skills, and the responsibilities an applicant will be assuming, all more accurate indicators that are less likely to be affected by discrimination. Minnesota would not be the first public policy body to recognize the harm caused by prior salaries being relied upon for future salaries. The EEOC has long advised against relying on salary history in hiring. That's the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the federal agency charged with eliminating employment discrimination in our country. The Office of Personnel Management has advised federal hiring entities not to use it because of the effect on people who have had time out of the workforce. Several states, Massachusetts, most recently California, Delaware, and Oregon, have all banned the practice. And cities, including New York City, San Francisco, and Philadelphia, have all, often with bipartisan support, stopped reliance on salary history. New York and New Jersey have prohibited state agencies from taking it into account. And perhaps most importantly, in the private sector, a growing number of companies have already committed to do this. They have stated publicly they will not use prior salary to determine compensation. And these include Amazon, the Bank of America, and Wells Fargo, not tiny companies. Others have even gone so far as to adopt completely transparent pay structures, but that's a yet another. That's not what's being asked of this committee or Minnesotans at this time. The wage gap has stagnated. You've heard it over and over again. I read it over and over again. It hasn't budged in over a decade. We need policy solutions to close it, and no one will do it, but everyone counts and is important. In Massachusetts, the bill was unanimously passed. It had broad bipartisan support, clearly, and was supported by the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. The same could be true here. The time to act is now, and I urge you to support Representative Thiessen's House File 2913. Thank you for hearing me out.
Representative Thiessen, do you have any additional testifiers?
I don't, Mr. Chair.
All right. Next on the testifier list is Cam Witten from the Chamber, and this is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? So, Mr. Witten, you'll be the last testifier. Please state your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, for the record, Cam Winton, Director of Labor Management Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Nice to see everyone. As I think folks know, the chamber is comprised of 2,300 companies here in Minnesota. Between them, the members of the chamber have 500,000 employees. We're proud to be the voice of Minnesota's employers. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce opposes this bill.
Oh.
I'd like to share with you three key reasons why we do. First and foremost, and if you hear nothing else today, please hear this. It is illegal today in the state of Minnesota to discriminate in pay towards an employee based on that employee's sex. MnStat 181.67, the Equal Pay for Equal Work Law. I want to reiterate that. It is illegal today under current law to discriminate against employees on the basis of sex when deciding how much to pay them. So what this bill would do is make it illegal for an employer to ask a question. It would add to what already exists in law. It would make it illegal for an employer to ask a question of an employee, and it's a question that many employees and employers in the state of Minnesota have found helpful for legitimate business purposes to determine if they're even in the same ballpark when it comes to pay. Before I say a little more about how this law would negatively impact employers here in Minnesota by throwing sand in the gears of their basic hiring processes, let me just note a couple other things about this distinction I'm drawing between the fact that it is already illegal in the state of Minnesota to discriminate against someone on the basis of their sex when deciding how much to pay them, and what this bill would do, again, making it illegal to ask a question. Federal and state law don't make it illegal for the whole range of employment and HR-related things. They don't make it illegal to ask questions. They, of course, make it illegal to discriminate based on gender, based on race, based on veteran status, et cetera, the whole long list. And that's entirely proper, just as it is entirely proper that there is a law in Minnesota prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sex here. But those laws do not prohibit asking questions. Now, employers choose to avoid asking questions about race, about gender, because there's no legitimate business purpose. But in contrast here, I want to keep emphasizing there are many legitimate business purposes when employers and employees come together and try to figure out if the one can hire the other at a rate that the one can afford and the other chooses to work for. I want to put a quick asterisk on what I just said. My categorical statement is true with one exception, and that is in the category of federal disability law. It's my understanding that federal disability law does prohibit asking questions about disabilities. Mm-hmm. But in every other thing I said, there's no prohibition on asking the questions, but again, the employers choose not to because there's no legitimate business purpose. So if I could, let me turn to the legitimate business purposes that Minnesota's employers find and employees seem to find as well for asking about salary history. If I'm an employer, and as I've shared with some of you, I was in business before I got to the chamber, if we were trying to figure out whether we could afford someone, that was a pretty important threshold question. We didn't have a big HR department. We had one person who really ran our HR department. That person had a lot on their plate. We weren't able to spend weeks and weeks courting an employee if we were just going to get to the end of the movie and decide that, oh my gosh, they're asking for something way different than what we were asking for. And so there was a legitimate business purpose for inquiring about that person's history. Now, there's nothing that locks in that employees are choosing to work for us at that history, but to even understand if you're in the same ballpark, if there could be a fit, it's a business practice that's useful. I also want to emphasize that in our current environment, we have 3.3% unemployment in Minnesota. That's compared to 4.1% nationally. That's Deeds data, seasonally adjusted. 3.3% unemployment here in Minnesota. Employees can and do hold out for more money, more power to them. We're seeing wages rise faster than they've risen in about 8 years. That's a good thing for Minnesotans. So this practice, this bill would throw sand in the gears of those legitimate business purposes where employees and employers are having free-flowing conversations with each other. Let me close with one thing, and it may seem a bit theoretical, but I think it's worth mentioning. The existing body of law says that companies do have free speech rights. Now, let's just state candidly that some folks don't like that fact because oftentimes we look at that question in the context of political giving. And, yes, reasonable minds can disagree about that. But let's just note that American law establishes that companies do have free speech rights. The test, the doctrine, is called the Central Hudson Test. For any of you others who went to lawyer school, it's a four-point test. I'll just cover the most important two. Is the asserted government interest substantial? This is what the Central Hudson case in the United States Supreme Court asked. If you're talking about, may the government prohibit a company's employees, like a hiring manager, from engaging in speech? Is the asserted government interest substantial? And then number two, does the regulation directly advance the governmental interest asserted in a way that is more extensive than necessary or not more extensive than necessary? If it's more extensive than necessary, then the government can't do that regulation. So in this case, Representative Thiessen has conveyed, and of course I take him at his word, that the stated purpose of this bill is to erase the gap in pay. Well, of course that's a compelling government interest, and of course we all share that goal. I bet we could all go around the table and talk about women in our lives who we want to see get paid as much as humanly possible, every penny they're worth. So this bill does check that box. I'll grant you that, Representative Thiessen. This bill checks that first prong of the Central Hudson Test. But it fails the other ones. Does the regulation directly advance the asserted government purpose? Well, no. Respectfully, we've heard even from the bill's advocates that this bill is a roundabout sort of measure to address an important problem. But no, it's not direct. And is it more extensive than necessary? Yes, it is more extensive than necessary. It would prohibit employers from asking questions. So in conclusion, Mr. Chair and members, and I do appreciate the time here. If you like this bill, and you think that the government should forbid this speech, I would ask you to consider future scenarios where another bill comes along proposing to prohibit companies from engaging in speech that you like. So if this bill is allowed to go forward, then, okay, the next bill is going to say, for just pulling examples out of the air, a company is not allowed to ask its power provider for renewable energy. What? A company is not allowed to ask customers at a grocery store whether that customer wants a paper bag or a plastic bag. A company's not allowed to ask a customer if they want GMO food or GMO-free food. Now, you may think these examples ridiculous, but there's no discerning legal principle that prohibits you from doing any of those if you do the one today. So in conclusion, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce opposes this bill. I'd be happy to stand for questions, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Any comments from you before we go to member comments and questions?
Yes.
Representative Thiessen.
Just to address some of the issues, okay, it is illegal today, and that statute is absolutely true that was put into place, that you can't discriminate on the basis of gender and wages. That bill was passed in 1969. Mm-hmm. We still have a gap that is 83 cents on the dollar, and it's been stagnant for 10 years. So clearly just making it illegal has not closed the pay gap. So I don't think that necessarily hands up. We do make it illegal to ask questions, and not only the disability. We passed a bill, as one example, at least in an initial phase, called the Ban the Box, where at least on the initial application, you cannot ask someone if they have a criminal record. We passed that with strong bipartisan support in 2013. I don't think it's legal to ask someone if they're married or if they have a partner. I think that's illegal under Minnesota law. There's numerous questions that employers cannot ask in the hiring process. So I think that's just actually not a true, accurate statement. The employer, I think it's important to note here that the employee can offer this information at their discretion. So if the employee chooses to offer what their past salaries have been, That is certainly the case. But the fundamental argument, and I think the most potent argument that Mr. Winton raised, is this question of, is there a legitimate business purpose for doing this? And the argument that was made is that you don't want to send people down this long path of negotiation only to find out that the person, that the potential employee, wants more money than the employer can offer. That was kind of the essential argument. I think what the witnesses have said, what Ms. Stratton has said, I think is really important. I want to reiterate that is not the only way to achieve that end. And probably the de-biased way, I like that word, hiring policy, effective way to address that is to understand what you are willing to offer for this position up front and say, this is what the salary range is going to be up front, so people can come in and make that decision earlier. There's no reason that you have to go through the whole hiring process. There's other ways to avoid going through a whole hiring process only to find this out at the last minute. I don't think that that is a legitimate business purpose. Maybe it is, but I don't think it outweighs the impact that we know from research asking for wage history or salary history has on perpetuating the wage gap. And so I think it's important for us to remember that I just don't believe that this is a necessary business practice to ask this question. There are other ways to get at that. As regards to this free speech argument, actually was challenged in Philadelphia, as I understand it, and I think the initial decision of the court was not to find that this violated free speech. I think the case is still pending, but that was the initial conclusion of the court. What the test that Mr. Winton is talking about for the lawyers here is really what we call a rational basis test. And so if there is any rational basis for connecting the law that we would pass in this case to not allow someone to ask a question with the ultimate result of trying to close the wage gap, if there is any rational connection between those two, it would survive the Central Hudson test. And I think that is clear based on the research that Ms. Stratton talked about and what we know about how these questions do perpetuate these wage gaps going forward, that like the case in Philadelphia, this would withstand that scrutiny. It's very different, for instance, from the Citizens United case, where we're talking about specifically very central, free, in some people's perspective, very essential political speech. So that addresses Mr. I'll stop with that.
Thank you.
Questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wondered if your testifier, Representative Thiessen, can come back to the table, Ms. Stratton.
Ms. Stratton, welcome back to the committee. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Stratton, I'm just wondering, since the passage of the WISA Act in 2014 or 15?
14.
14? Thank you. How much has that wage gap closed?
And remember, just for those who are not familiar with the acronym, WISA is the Women's Economic Security Act. So not everyone knows it. The testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are teeny tiny moves, which I could not cite you precisely, but it has basically not budged in over a decade. But this body also did not include some of the wage equality pieces that were originally proposed to be part of it. I think we can, but this legislature did approve some monitoring of equal pay practices for government contractors, which was a great thing, and I think that the Department of Human Rights is proceeding along with starting to do audits. So
okay.
That was the only piece of WISA that actually went directly to wages.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what might we expect? How will the needle move if this bill passes in your estimation?
To the testifier.
I am a lawyer rather than a statistician, so I don't want to hazard a guess. I think it's very, very clear that what we've been doing up to now is not working. And we can only do what studies and research indicate could help. There have been some studies done about some of the jurisdictions where this has been in place, but it hasn't been in place for a long time. If you, I could send the committee that research if it's helpful. But it has indicated that having that factor removed that is not particularly rational, the basing on prior salary, has made employers change their practices. You know, it has encouraged them to look at the more job-related aspects of salary ranges. You know, I mean, another thing we could do, if we want more things to do, I can come up with a whole list. requiring publishing of salary ranges is part of one of the other state laws that has just passed. That's another way of it deals also with the issue that Representative Thiessen addressed about, you know, how are we going to know we're going to get people applying to us who have all different kinds of salary expectations. So publishing salary range can take care of that.
Representative Scott.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. The other states that have passed this similar legislation, has it been the exact kind of same elements to their pieces with the damages and with the civil action, not requirements, but the availability to do that?
To the testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Each one is slightly different, and there are components. Some of them prohibit asking. Some of them prohibit asking and reliance upon. And enforcement mechanisms vary. So I honestly, off the top of my head, can't tell you exactly what each one's civil enforcement scheme is.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. So I wanted to ask Representative Thiessen a couple of questions just about the bill language, and I don't know, maybe the testifier needs to stay at the table. On line 1.19, the word remuneration, what all would that include, or can you define that?
Representative Thiessen.
My understanding, maybe we can go to the to council as well, since they drafted the language. But my understanding is kind of the amount that you would get paid. So it would include, I don't know that it would include benefits, but it would include your wages and salary, and presumably it would also include bonuses and things like that. So, but maybe if we go to council.
Ms. Shaleen?
I think someone.
Mr. Weeks. Yes, right, yeah. Weeks would be.
Chair Garofalo, Representative Scott. Yeah, it's meant to include any and all compensation for employment, so everything.
So commission, the whole nine yards?
Chair Garofalo, Representative Scott, yeah, commission is included.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
I'm sorry, did he say that it does, Mr. Chair, does it include benefits?
Mr. Weeks.
Chair Garofalo, Representative Scott, yeah, I read it to include benefits, because that's the thing of value you get for working.
All right, great, thank you. Just wanted that clarified. And on page 2.1, the phrase there, information about past wages, what might that include? I don't know if Representative Thiessen wants to take that or the testifier.
Either Mr. Weeks or Representative Thiessen.
Chair Garofalo, Representative Scott. So wages is defined as any and all remuneration, and this says any past wages, so it's meant to be broad. So any and all compensation a person's got for working in the past.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could a person ask a potential employee, was your salary, were you paid based on commission or salary or an hourly wage, a mixture of those? Could they ask those types of questions according to this bill?
Mr. Chair, yes. I would imagine that you could. You just can't ask about the amount of it, yes. And we did do, yeah. And remember, we also added the information, the amendment as well, clarifying some productivity measures that you can ask about.
Representative Scott.
Right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that it's really all that clear about if you can ask about how they were, the structure of their pay, because I think some employers may be even afraid to ask that question. Then one of my other questions would be on line 2.3, says require that a prospective employee's prior wage or salary history meet certain criteria. What would that criteria be?
Representative Thiessen?
I think what it's asking is that would be the criteria defined by the employer. So you can't ask, whether your past salary was over $100,000, as an example.
Representative Scott.
So not only can you not ask specifically what was your past wages, but you couldn't ask questions that would get at that question in a different way, like was your salary over $100,000?
Representative Scott.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That seems still a little bit vague, but anyway. and then the difference between a class action and a collective action remedy, just wondering why both of those are offered.
Representative Thiessen.
I would defer to Mr. Weeks again, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Weeks.
Chair Garofalo, Representative Scott, they're both included because it was intended to be broad. Generally, the difference between a class and collective action, my understanding is that a class action, everyone who meets certain criteria in a group is assumed to be one of the plaintiffs, whereas a collective action, the default rule is the opposite. So people have to affirmatively choose to be in the lawsuit, and this has been to allow either type.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a lot of concerns with this bill. I think it's on the vague side, and I think – oh, one other question, Mr. Chair. Would this apply to headhunters or job agencies? Often, you know, I've known people, including my husband, that have gone through those, and then one of the first questions they ask is what your past salary is or what you're expecting for a salary. So would there be any harm in those folks asking that question?
Representative Thiessen.
So, I mean, two things there. I think, first of all, no, everybody can you can still ask about your expectation under this bill of what salary is. You just can't ask what your salary is, just to make that clear for everybody. And second, employer means an entity having one or more employees in Minnesota. I mean, we could clarify that. I don't think it should be intended for headhunters. So if we need to make a clarification on that, that's certainly a legitimate. They certainly would be an employer, but
the headhunters. Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Oh. The headhunter's going to tell the potential employee or the employer what this candidate, you know.
Well, then maybe we won't make that exception, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Maybe I'll start with our current witness and the author of the bill. So let's just make it clear again. I think you said it, and I'll just say it again. It's clear that the employer can advertise ahead of time what the salary range is, what the benefits are, all of those things. It seems like the concern of the opposition from Mr. Nguyen was, oh, my goodness, there's going to be this long long time where there's going to be people not knowing what they can count on in this job and everything. It seems to me there's absolutely nothing under freedom of speech or of the part of the other language of this bill that prevents the employer from advertising what the offered salary is, what the offered benefits are, all of those. Let's just be really clear about that. There doesn't need to be a long protracted time. People who are applying for the job will know that ahead of time if the employer wants to do that. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Now, thank you. I want to thank you, Representative Thiessen, for bringing this forward. I have heard quite a bit of research about this particular issue. And one of the things that happens, and I don't know if you, maybe the witness wants to share any of this information, but one of the things that happens is I think if we pass legislation like this, we are impacting the consciousness of women who are applying for jobs, because pretty often what I understand the research shows is that we ask for less. If there is an opportunity, pretty often we don't expect that we're going to get higher salaries, and so we ask for less. And I'm just wondering if you've thought about or if you could just report on some of the research, the data that shows that women consistently first of all, your information shows women do not get the same offers, but secondly, we don't ask because we are pretty used to the fact that there's going to be a lower pay. Can you just talk about that a little bit? I've heard, a number of stories about that in the media.
Representative Thiessen, or to the testifier? Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, it's a very good question. It's an interesting one, and there are a lot of facets to it.
I would say I'm not so sure that it's all that clear. And again, I am not a statistician, so with that caveat, I'm summarizing research that I've read or read about. But it is not always the case that women don't ask, but due to there is research on implicit biases operating in the hiring process, and that when women, you know, I'm sure that you all have heard or read research about women don't negotiate, which is not, it presents a double bind for women, because if they do, if they don't negotiate, they're going to get the first salary they're offered, right? Which can create the disparity if a man is allowed to negotiate his hire. And even if all women in a job hiring negotiation asked every, you know, pushed as hard as they possibly could for a higher wage, many of them wouldn't get hired. I mean, that's what the research says. The implicit bias, the stereotype is that women are asking, you're being too aggressive, they weren't very nice. There are a number of adjectives that tend to come up in the studies, but the bottom line is women are not perceived the same as men when they negotiate aggressively. There's, you know, the psychologists have a word for it of role incongruence. You know, our expected role for women is when it doesn't meet what's required in the business setting, women often pay a price by being evaluated less positively. So there's that. And in terms of, now I've lost my own train. So there's the implicit bias piece, I think, makes it really important. And there is social science backing up what you started your question with, this that posits that women tend to undervalue their own skills, you know, even skills, the skills themselves, not even only their monetary worth to an employer, but their level of preparation, their skills, and what they should be making, and that men conversely tend to, of course, these are all generalizations, but these are studies, that's what they do is generalize, tend to overvalue their qualifications and their experience and their value. So I think you were naming something important there also.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page one of the bill, under section 2, subdivision 1, it talks about some definitions. And when I turn over to page 2, line 2.1, the first word there is seek. And I'm curious of the author, what is the definition of seek?
Representative Thiessen.
Ask for that information, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, if I were to seek information on the internet about a job that you previously held and I was interested in hiring you, is that defined as seek?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it probably would, yes.
Representative Thiessen.
And Mr. Chair, I think that would probably exist only, though, for, you know, the top five employees of public companies, right, where the information is public, or it might apply to us. They would know what our, they could find out what our salary is, because that's public information.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was thinking along those lines. There, I believe that there are several people in state government, particularly who are commissioners and executive directors and so forth of all different persuasions, whose salaries we've debated here in the legislature in the past few years have been increased, and those salaries are online. If a company sees those online, has that been, would that fall into the definition of seek?
Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Representative Fabian.
Okay, well, thank you. So then, if I may, on line 2.2, under civil actions and civil penalties, there's, 2.4, I'm sorry, did I say 2.2? In addition to other relief, then there's a civil penalty of $1,000 per violation. In 181.171, what other relief is available there for the aggrieved.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Weeks?
Mr. Weeks.
Chair Garofalo and Representative Fabian, if you flip back to the first page of the bill, and lines 1.7 to 1.13, that's the relevant part of 181.171, and that's just general section allowing people to bring a suit in court to get civil penalties and damages. So it says there are compensatory damages and other appropriate relief, but including but not limited to injunction relief.
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and then the same thing kind of pops into my head on 2.7, Part B, B, and then also in C. Are there any? So on 2.11, and where they talk about compensatory damages, and then 2.12 and 1.3, exemplary damages. I'm curious, are there any caps built in on those?
Mr. Weeks. Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, it says equal amount, so it would be double the damages.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, it doesn't say that, though under B, I don't see the equal amount there.
Yeah.
Am I missing it?
2.12.
There's no exemption.
Right, but I'm saying B, not C. That's C. It says plus an equal amount.
Mr.
B,
Chair.
There's collective and class action.
Representative Thiessen.
I think that B doesn't address the amount of damages at all. It just says the type of action that you can bring. And then C would qualify that any exemplary damages that you would receive in any kind of proceeding would be capped at basically an equal amount to the actual compensatory damages, the actual amount lost.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have some concerns about the bill, and I'm sure the discussion will continue. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was actually one of the authors of WESA and did a lot of research back then about the pay gap. And I was actually very surprised when I got a report from the Legislative Commission on Economic Status of Women. And the director at that time came in and had a conversation with me. And what was so surprising is that the pay gap between men and women could be substantiated with many reasons, education levels, that women worked less hours overall, that they requested flex time to take care of children. They left the workforce to have children and then later take care of children. They chose fields that had lower pay overall, less demands, less dangerous. And so I'm wondering if the Legislative Commission the Legislative Commission on Economic Status of Women is actually here, because they are the experts for the pay gap in Minnesota. I'm hoping they're here. They're not here.
No.
Because when they actually talked about it to me, they said that the unknown factor was less than 0.5%, which would be relevant to this bias against women. They just couldn't substantiate it when we worked on this back in 2014. So I was hoping they'd be here, that they could actually speak to it themselves, since they are the experts of women's economic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Next on the list is Representative.
Mr. Chairman.
Hold on. Representative Clark, do you want to?
Well, shouldn't we note to the member that we eliminated the salaries of the economic status of women, so that, you know, they don't exist anymore as paid staff. We don't have them as our staff anymore.
Yeah. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have a couple of questions. I'm in my day job a contractor, and so I don't have any rights as an employee, haven't for 10 years. But I'm not an employment lawyer, but I do have a couple of questions. Under current law, are former employers allowed to disclose the compensation of an employee if asked by a prospective employer?
To the testifier or Representative Thiessen or to Mr. Weeks or whoever wants to answer it. Representative Thiessen.
I don't know under current law, but they would not be able to under this bill.
Well, so Representative Munson.
Okay, I think your testifier is an attorney. I was wondering if they were able to disclose that information to a prospective employer.
With respect to
to the testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to current employees, you're asking?
Representative Munson.
Or current law is what I meant to say.
Current employment law, I'm wondering if it's my understanding that employers are prohibited from disclosing to third parties what the salaries were of previous employees.
Ms. Stratton.
Perhaps Mr. Weeks knows better than I do, because that's not my understanding of current law. Most employers require a release, but not all do.
Mr. Weeks, do you want to chime in?
Representative Garofalo, Chair Garofalo, Representative Munson, I don't know of anything in current law that prohibits a past employer from disclosing the salary it paid to an employee.
Okay.
Representative Munson.
And I guess my follow-up question would be, under current law, is there a civil penalty for prospective employees possibly misrepresenting their previous salary?
Representative Thiessen.
I don't know.
Representative Munson.
Okay, well, so I'll go on wondering. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney and Howell.
The original reason I raised my hand was to help the chair remind the committee of what we did with the economic women's economic security department. But I think we're all pretty clear on what happened to that last year. I'm just kind of shocked at how much trouble this bill is bringing forth. There is no doubt, there's no question that women are paid less for the same work 3%. Ever. I mean, for Caucasian women, it's 83 cents on the dollar. For a Latino woman, it's 50 cents on the dollar. For African American or Native American, it is still in the 50 cents range. And we are sitting here having a fight over whether we should try to figure out a way to close that wage gap so that whether it's a single mother or a partner in a relationship can be equal partners. I don't understand why even an employer would not want to have a female or male employee, but importantly, a female employee have the same status as a male employee in their business. It's sad that we actually have to make a law for the 5 or 10% of employers that I will nicely call knuckleheads and try to keep their employees in a more subservient position. We are now in a situation, and I appreciated the chamber lobbyists coming up and talking about how good the Minnesota economy is at 3.1% unemployment versus 4% nationally. We have people coming back. Our unemployment rate would be even less if we weren't now starting to find more and more people coming back into the workforce because they have hope again. This bill is a way to help women be on an equal footing financially as men. Women in this world are just as responsible for the bills that they or their family create as a male, and there is no reason why we should not do everything in our role as legislators to further that goal. We have found false reasons. We have found tangents that are so far off in the distance that they shouldn't even validity could almost be called into question. Could this bill be tightened up or reworded in a number of different places? Yes. But by and large, the principle of this bill is that women should be treated as equals in the wage world in America. And for that particular reason, this is a great bill. As a man who has two daughters, who actually do negotiate pretty well and apparently have a reputation that is similar to their father's in terms of nicety. One of my children was told she had to be nicer if she was going to be involved in Chicago politics. So
I can see the glimmer in your eye and the pride in your words.
There was so much joy in that particular moment. But this bill actually is a great bill to help women stand on their own two feet in equality with men and in the financial world. And I think this is a great bill. If we have to change a word or two here, that so be it. But this is something that should be moving forward without a lot of arguments.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at the bill, and I don't know how this applies to contract employees. And how does that work with them? It doesn't look like it addresses contract employees at all.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we're talking about like independent contractors,
Representative Howell.
I would say that falls into it also.
Representative Thiessen.
Okay, so for independent contractors, I don't think it would apply at all. If you're talking, like, for instance, in my law firm, I'm a contract employee, you know, because I operate not on kind of their typical, you know, because I'm not there very much. I don't operate on their typical salary. I just get paid for every hour I work. I think in that sense of a contract employee, this would apply. But if we're talking independent contractors, I don't think this would not apply to that.
Representative Huh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen. So if I've got two contract employees doing the same work, I can have them at two different scales. I can have them at two different percentages. I can do whatever I negotiate with them. And because they fail to negotiate a better rate, that's their loss.
Representative, was that a question? Or
it is.
Okay, Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Representative Howe.
Well, I'm a contractor with an employer, and I've got my contract, and I base my rate. Someone else, different gender, different race, comes in and negotiates a different rate. I guess that's where I'm coming from. How does this apply to make that an even basis?
Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that this would necessarily apply to address that issue. You know, so you know, this is just asking about the question you can ask during the hiring process. So it would not. I don't think it would get at that issue one way or another.
Representative Howell?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my concern is if they ask me what I'm charging a different jurisdiction, I generally speak and I tell them. But now if I'm not quite sure if this would allow them to ask that. And I'm concerned that if someone's competing with me, or if they need more than one contractor and they're of different genders and they ask that question, that's where I think it might cast a little bit wider net than what we're looking for. I'm not quite sure how this applies to that.
And Mr. Chair, that sounds like an independent contractor situation, and this bill wouldn't apply to that.
Representative Dabney, you get the last comment question, and then we'll go to the author for a closing comment.
Oh, my word. Didn't anticipate that, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm reminded of a visit I had from a constituent last week who formerly worked for a major Minnesota employer, born and bred Minnesota firm that had a large national presence in its industry, the kind of company we like to talk about bipartisanly. And then they were.
Daphne, that's not a word. Bipartisanly is not a word. And if we can debate this for hours until the night, but you will stand corrected on that point that bipartisanly is not a word.
And
Daphne.
Mr. Chair, thank you for correcting me. And to my shame, I used it in a tweet last week. Yeah, I know. It was a good tweet, though. So I kept it. So on a bipartisan basis, this is the kind of company that we all like to talk about and we all like to own. Minnesota born and bred, national presence, important in its industry. And then it got purchased by a foreign company. And in the transition there, she found that this good employer with solid benefits and all of that was paying her, as a college-educated professional, 50% of what it was paying her male colleagues. And to the contention that women don't make as much as men because they tend not to be in professions that are as dangerous or demanding, I would ask you to spend 8 or more, maybe even more likely 10 or 12 hours with a nurse who's exposed to contagious diseases, who sometimes has to deal with violent patients or their family members under great stress, who many end up with back injuries and other injuries from having to lift patients who can't move themselves. Or you can even go to the grocery store. You ever look at the wrists of the cashiers at the grocery store and see how many of them are wearing braces from repetitive motion injuries from scanning the food that you're buying? Those injuries are real when they get to surgery. It hurts, I'm told. Many of them end up with back problems from the hours that they spend standing on their feet largely in one place. And my profession, teaching, I will skip the request we've had for teachers to take bullets in protecting their children. That's a discussion for a different day, but our inaction on gun safety has created that. But we don't value as a society the emotional demands of a lot of industries that women tend to dominate in. And I can tell you that the emotional demands of being a teacher, when you've got 30 or 35 or more kids in a class with varying demands and varying demands of their parents and varying demands of the administration, is a real, genuine, demanding job that the chair hears about, I'm betting, most every night at home over the dinner table. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the bill, Representative Thiessen.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just a couple of things in closing. We've spent a lot of time, and appropriately so, on the gender pay gap. I do think it's important that we come back to one of Ms. Stratton's earlier points that, this is even more pronounced for people of color. And something I hadn't thought of, but she mentioned, and I think is worth reiterating, this also addresses people that are seeking second, getting up in age and moving into a different career, who are actually priced out of the market because they make too much. And when they're asked that question, they're going to be kind of dropped out of the hiring process mm-hmm. in general. So it's not just about the gender wage gap. It's about a whole variety of folks who face challenges. There was a question raised about the structure of pay. I'm not sure why you would have to ask that question, frankly, why the employer would need to know what the structure of your past pay was. For the same reasons, you wouldn't need to know about what the actual pay was. To the point about flex time and time off that that Representative Neal raised, I think that's exactly the reason that we need this kind of bill, because it's those decisions that women make, for many women more often than men, both, but more, women more often than men make, that starts to build in this gap, right, in wages. And so if we're asking about the salary, those decisions that are made early in a career, again, as Ms. Stratton pointed out, get perpetuated. So I think this is exactly the kind of bill that could actually address some of those challenges. And what we've seen in other jurisdictions, and I think it's important to note this, there is going to be hopefully some movement in how this affects the wage gaps. And there are studies that would suggest that that's the case. But what's more important, and the impact that we do know that this has had in other jurisdictions, is to change the hiring policies and practices of employers, moving toward these more unbiased types of approaches, saying what your salary range is going to be, figuring out what an individual, regardless of gender or any other distinction, should be paid, in terms of the skills they bring to it, in terms of what's demanded by the employer. Why we can't start with that type of approach instead of starting where the employer is trying to leverage someone's lower salary to drive down, you know, that's what this is about at the end of the day, members. What the employers want to preserve is the right, and, you know, I get it, but the right to pay people as little as possible in a sense. You know, not to pay them under what they're worth, but to pay them as to give them a negotiating tool to pay them less than they might otherwise have to pay them. You know, that at the end of the day is what this is about. This is a negotiating tool. It's not a negotiating tool that we need. It's not a negotiating tool that serves any particular good ends, and we know that it is going to perpetuate these gender and color and age gaps in our wages. So I'm not sure why we need to do it. In terms of the enforcement, I think that there are legitimate questions raised there. That's why when this bill passes, I look forward to going to Representative Scott's committee, because that's exactly where those types of issues should be addressed in the Civil Law Committee. And I think the motion is to go to Civil Law, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chair.
That's what it is right now.
So, and I guess, you know, what I would say at the end of the day here, and I think we should ask ourselves, is if we know that this is going to have a positive impact on changing hiring policies, if we know that it's going to have an impact through that on and be one of the tools in the toolbox of trying to close these wage gaps that aren't based on anything except characteristics of individuals, you know, in particular gender. If we know that that's the case, and we know that there are alternatives that are better, why do you have to ask the question? I don't think the Chamber of Commerce, I don't think anybody has legitimately raised a reason of why this question needs to be asked. And I think that's the question we need to ask ourselves. Why does this question need to be asked? And if there's not a good answer for why this question needs to be asked, I don't know why we don't pass this bill that I think will have a beneficial thing. And this is not going to burden anybody. It's very easy to do. Just don't ask the damn question. And then you don't get into trouble. Right? And so I think this is just a very simple bill. I know that the chair would like me to ask to lay this over. I'd actually like to vote on the bill. And so, Mr. Chair.
Okay, roll call, Ben Crested. Representative Jason, are you going to modify your motion to renew this to have the bill laid over for possible inclusion, or do you want to stick with it as it is?
Mr. Chair, it depends on if it's legitimately has a chance to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Well, again, you know my request. I would prefer you lay this over you modify your motion to lay it over for possible inclusion, but you're the author of the bill, and you get to decide that, so I'll give you one more chance to make that motion.
I think we should just vote.
All right. The chair moves that we table House File 2913 as amended. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is on the table. Members, we have reached the end of our agenda for the day. We'll see everyone tomorrow. With that, we are adjourned.